Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Kofi in Washington, D.C.
Women are not so much taken seriously in our cultures in Africa. We need to empower women. So that is one of the pillars. We call it maternal and child health and women's economic empowerment.
Former Ethiopian Prime Minister opens up about dialogue with former African leaders to help resolve pressing issues facing the continent.
We were looking forward to something more like August. The junta had given a two-year transition starting with the August coup of 2023. So most people were expecting if the rendezvous was met, it would have been August 2025. April is precipitous. But I think it's good news, and people are happy about it.
Gabon schedules a presidential election for April.
We will emerge from the election, from the experience, not only with euphoria, but with renewed optimism and dedication.
And the new chairman of Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, demands electoral and constitutional reforms ahead of the coming elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. His Ethiopia's immediate past Prime Minister, Haile Mariam Desalegn, was among a select group of former African heads of state invited by the Multicultural Coalition Inaugural Ball Committee to Washington this week. The former Ethiopian leader led a delegation of the African Legacies Institute, or ALI, to participate in the inaugural festivities for the second Donald Trump presidency. Haile Mariam Desalegn stopped by the VOA Washington studios for an interview with me. In part one of this conversation, he talked about what he is currently doing and the conversations with former African leaders about coming together to help resolve some of the pressing issues facing the continent.
I have a number of hats that I wear. First of all, I do have a foundation which I established or co-founded with my wife. Mm-hmm. It's called Haile Mariam and Roman Foundation. And that foundation works on very critical issues that foundations like ours can support what governments are doing. Mm-hmm. You know, governments cannot do everything, mm-hmm. so we need to support and fill the gap which exists within the system. And we also, you know, a number of menus has been there, but we wanted to have four pillars which are very important. For the future of Africa, we need our children being well-fed, well-educated, and or their moms also has to be taken care carefully, mm-hmm. and also economically empowered. You know, women are not so much taken seriously in our cultures in Africa. We need to empower women. So that is one of the pillars. We call it maternal and child health and women's economic empowerment. Mm-hmm. The second one is, you know that Africa has a very young population. Right. And most of them are unemployed, impatient. And we have to address the quest of our young people. Mm-hmm. That's a very good comparative advantage for us and Africans.
Right. Talking about that, some people have expressed concern that some of you former leaders are being treated unfairly. Some say you are being witch-hunted. Others are saying when you left the stage, you're just quiet. Some go to their farms. They are not doing anything. So do you think the narrative that you are not doing enough to help those currently in power to move the continent forward is accurate?
The narrative we are not doing enough is accurate, mm. but there is a mixed badge you can see mm. what's happening. Mm. There are few who work very closely with their successors. Mm-hmm. A good example can be shown, like in Tanzania and a little bit in my own country, Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. But there are others where you can see that former leaders are witch-hunted and excluded from what's happening in their own country. Mm-hmm. So because of that, some of them has become very critical, and so it becomes confrontational. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as you said, some say, okay, they abdicate and they go, okay, let me work in my farm, mm-hmm. and some other issues than supporting the current government, and it's, you know, works that happens. Even when some come from the same party, there has been some pushes and pulls that needs to be addressed properly. I think that's why now we are saying there is a mixed result. So we have to bring this into discussion and dialogue and bring about a change on the how of creating the African leadership legacy. Mm-hmm. For the former leaders to engage and bring about a change.
So are the discussions ongoing with these African legacies?
Yes, I think we are in the process of establishing the Institute of African Legacy, mm-hmm. Which is one of the premium institutions that can help, you know, galvanize these things together. It's very important for the coming generation to understand that leaders has their own comparative advantage in terms of wealth of experience and knowledge and skill, because when you go through and pass through that, you know, put that shoe, mm-hmm. it's different from when you just think from outside.
Right.
So we better understand our new leaders that succeed us than somebody, academic or researcher,
right.
who knows the theory but lacks the practice.
Right.
So I think these wells of practice and experience helps us to understand better. Even when we made some mistakes when we were in office, mm-hmm. we tried to help that these kind of mistakes shouldn't repeat. Mm-hmm. You have to learn. If you are not idiot, you have to learn. Mm-hmm. from the past mistake. Mm-hmm.
So do you think we
can advise on those areas, but nonetheless, it's not only individual advice, but it should be a legacy collectively that also passes into the new generation.
Mm-hmm. I was about to ask you that, because if you have this bank of knowledge where all these former leaders can pass on these pieces of advice to current generations, like you were a former head of the African Union, you were confronted with a lot of insecurity challenges, food shortages, how you handled it and what you think can be done now with that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. Do you think the current leaders will be accept, you know, will embrace that in order to try to resolve the current challenges and move the continent forward? In your discussion, has that come up?
Yeah, actually, there is a short-termism. You know, the terms of leadership position that you stay is mm-hmm. limited
right.
by election cycle.
Right.
So some of the leaders think that it's a very short period of time, so I have to deliver my own way, mm-hmm. and so that when the time comes, I have to leave. But this kind of thinking is a very short-termism, which affects the country mm-hmm. At large. Because you have one country, and you need to have a sustainable long-term vision for the country. Mm-hmm. That can only happen beyond the election cycle. So maybe, you know, when parties contest for election, in the first place, democracy is not only election.
Right.
Democracy is building democratic culture from beneath, from our children, up to, you know, adults, and even elderly, passing the baton through the others. So I think that takes generational, you know, kind of project. Mm-hmm. So if that is the case, then we can't think in terms of a short period of time within our election cycle. Mm-hmm. We have to think beyond, because we have to think for our own countries.
Right.
So if that is the case, then there is a compelling need to bring about, you know, people together, formers, current leaders, even future leaders mm-hmm. that aspire to become presidents, prime ministers of their own countries. Mm-hmm. So that synergy is always needed.
Haile Mariam Desalegn is Ethiopia's former prime minister. He sat down with me in the VOA studios here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. You also can find the interview on voaafrica.com. Former African leaders are in discussions to come together to help countries on the continent resolve some of the challenges they face. Spearheading this initiative is the African Legacies Institute. The group seeks to preserve, honor, and promote the legacies of the democratically elected former African leaders who have exhausted the maximum constitutional allowable term limit. Former Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn is one of the African leaders. For more about the genesis, prospects, and the way forward for the African Legacies Institute, I reach Rachel Yayi. She is the co-founder of the African Legacies Institute.
So the conversation has been going on for years now with Madame Franya Cabral-Ruiz, who has worked for almost a decade with His Excellency Ernest Bai Koroma, former president of Sierra Leone. We had realized that former leaders were almost solely asked to come oversee elections throughout the continent, and whereas they have a whole lot more to contribute to the continent. And we felt that it is important that we seize every opportunity to learn from our former leaders, their successes, and also their struggles. And so what we aim to do is to create a platform for transfer of knowledge in a way to inspire future African leaders. And at the LI, we aim to inspire tomorrow by honoring yesterday. That's what we like to say. This is our goal here, preparing for tomorrow by honoring yesterday.
When did the conversation begin to have this actualized?
It has been ongoing for years. Every time we would hear about the situation with a former president, we were coming back to say, you see what's happening in this country or in that country. And we felt like it seems that sometimes people forget the sacrifices those leaders have done for their countries and for the continent. So it has been going on for years. So now, when did we really say we're moving, we have something to, let's do this? I will say over the past couple of years, it materialized, and here we are today.
Now, why is it important for these leaders to come together with a common goal, shared experience to pass on to those currently in power and those who will come in the near future?
We believe that the legacies of Africa's democratic leaders are the backbone of our history and the blueprint for our future. So these leaders, they have at their heart values like integrity, justice, and the rule of law, and their contribution continues to inspire generations. So we felt like it is important to preserve their legacies, as it ensures we stay connected to the principle that built our nations in Africa. So current leaders have a lot to learn from them. Future leaders have a lot to learn from them. And for us, truthful records remind us of the sacrifice made for democracy and help us hold on to the value that unites us.
Talking about truthfulness and in some cases distorting history, why is the African Legacy Institute important in this directive?
Peter, when we distort history to suit political narratives, for example, we erode trust and damage the foundation of democracy. Those leaders have been democratically elected by the people. Accurate documentation is not just about the past, it's about safeguarding the present and also the future.
So let me ask you, why do these legacies matter at all in the African context or anywhere else?
As President Theodore Roosevelt said, the more you know about the past, the better prepared you are for the future. So we believe that knowing what the history, knowing what happened in the political history of our countries, learning about what went well and what went wrong will help us. It would be unfortunate for future leaders to make, for example, the same mistake that the past leaders have made. We need to build upon their experience, their expertise, their know-how, their knowledge, their wisdom, so we get stronger and better.
What has been the responses of these former leaders when you approach them?
Well, they were excited. We have their full support. But you have to understand, we have over 36, 37 former head of state and government that we are blessed to have living in Africa. So they were excited. They showed their full support. And we know that there is a lot that still needs to be done. But we are excited and we are happy. We are blessed that we know that they are supporting us. As we told them, this is supposed to be a collaborative effort. It's not just us doing it. It's everybody together. Their former head of state and government, the current government, historian and communities, we must work together to document and celebrate these legacies so they continue to shape our shared identity.
Rachelle Yayi is the co-founder of the African Legacies Institute. She spoke with me from here in Washington. In Gabon, a political analyst says the announcement to hold a presidential election in April comes as a major surprise. Douglas Yates, professor of African Studies at the American Graduate School in Paris, says many had expected the poll to be held in August. This after the Gabonese Council of Elders announced the date for the presidential election following the coup led by General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema to overthrow longtime President Ali Bongo Ondimba. Some political analysts say the military leader will contest in the coming election, although General Nguema has yet to make an official announcement about his plans. For analysis, I reached Professor Douglas Yates.
Well, all I could say was that I was surprised at how quickly the elections have been announced. We were looking forward to something more like August. The junta had given the two-year transition starting with the August coup of 2023, so most people were expecting if the rendezvous was met, it would have been in August 2025. April is precipitous, but I think it's good news, and people are happy about it.
The announcement comes after, you know, last Sunday's adoption by Gabon's new parliament regarding an electoral code, or the electoral code that will be used to organize these elections. How significant is this?
Right. So one thing to note about the electoral code is that the report has not yet been published. So what we have are kind of leaks of certain information about the code. It's important. First of all, it's important because it follows the referendum in November, which had stated constitutionally there was nothing to stop members of the military from running in the election. Apparently, the code, according to leaks, also allows members of the military to run in elections. And that, of course, opens the door to General Brice Oligui Nguema to offer his candidacy. He hasn't yet announced it, but everyone is expecting he will. There's other things that we're seeing. One is that there'll be a quota that will ensure that the National Assembly and the legislative elections will have a minimum of 30% women. Also, 20% youth. This is a big deal because Gabon's kleptocracy was also a gerontocracy of aged party big men and their children in family political dynasties. So we're looking at a legislative election that might bring a lot of new blood in. That was also, that's reported to be in the code.
But do you think there could be any challenger at all that would give the military leader a run for his money, or this is just the way for him to pretty much strip down his military uniform and become a civilian president in the next 7 years?
Well, there, you know, I could answer yes to both sides of those. So this is, if he presents himself, going to be an effort to civilianize a military regime. And because the Constitution has been tailored to allow that, we have every reason to expect that's his intention. Now, will he run a fair and free election? A fair and free election would be against opposition candidates who have some stature. There are some politicians in the country who are willing to challenge him. People who stood up to Ali Bongo, one, for example, Albert Onda Osso. who was the United opposition candidate in 2023, the man who is reported to have won the last presidential election. At first, he was complaining that after the coup, he should be president. He toned that down. He's been preparing for a democratic transition, and he's been preparing for this election for a long time. It's clear if he runs, he'll get some votes, particularly among longtime opposition leaders. There's Pierre Clave Maganga Musabu, who has run in every presidential campaign since the democratic transition. He ran in 93, 98, 2009, 2016. He ran in the 2023 campaign. We expect he will run again. And then there's the last prime minister of Ali Bongo, Ali-Claude Billier-Diagne, who has a lot of support from former regime insiders. The former ruling party, the PDG, can't actually run as the PDG. But there's a large number of former ministers and prime ministers who are chameleons and who've changed their party colors. And Billier-Diagne is willing to speak out and present his candidacy. Whether or not it's going to be fair and free, and whether or not Oligui Nguema runs, those are questions still to be determined. But yeah, there'll be people who will stand in opposition, and if it's even somewhat fair and free, we'll be able to garner a large number of votes.
Douglas Yates is professor of African studies at the American Graduate School in Paris. He spoke with me from Paris. In the DRC, civil society groups in Goma are calling on the international community to act swiftly to stop the M23 rebels from taking over more territory in the eastern part of the country. It comes after the rebels seized the town of Minova, a key supply route for the provincial capital Goma. This, officials say, led to a major displacement of residents. The provincial governor of South Kivu, Jean-Jacques Perusi, confirmed the capture of Minova, adding that the rebels also captured the mining towns of Lumbishi, Numbi, and Shanje in the same province and the town of Bweremana in neighboring North Kivu province. For more on the calls by Civil Society for International Communities Intervention, I reached Placide Nzilamba, is the Executive Secretary of the Civil Society of North Kivu province in the DRC.
The people are there and observing us and to say how the government are saying about our situation, and us, we don't have the response because the situation now in North Kivu is very difficult. It's a very difficult situation because Goma has just become a died peace camp.
What does that mean? People are afraid? Is that what you are saying?
Yes, people are afraid. People are disappears. The M23 are attack areas without war, without fighting.
Have you seen any government FARDC soldiers anywhere near Goma fighting the rebels?
In Goma and the north part of Goma, all lines of front are also calm, but in the part of the south and the hours of the Goma town is where the front is very hot now. The situation, because of population of Zulu, they are coming now. They are running away to come in Goma.
With this M23 taking over, seizing towns like Minova in eastern Congo, does that mean that food supplies and much needed assistance cannot come in anymore?
Just now, there isn't the humanitarian way. And Minova, it was the principal on the major city who was living in Goma, all of eating and all water we can use in as the food in Goma. Now, since today and yesterday, no one can go in the Minova city. That's why we are in the situation of the presence in the Goma town.
I hear the Residents in Goma and surrounding areas are calling for national help to stop this rebel advancement to Goma. Is that a true reflection on the ground? Is that what people are saying?
Effectively, because the civil society of North Kivu province taken the spoken and says to international community to do what it can be prerogatives and to stop that war, because there are many persons who are leaving their homes, their villages, and they are running away because they are care for their life.
Placide Nzelamba is the executive secretary of the Civil Society of North Kivu Province in the DRC. He spoke with me from Goma. In Zambia, the secretary general of the opposition coalition called Tonse Alliance is calling on the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Speech to engage all stakeholders and to get a true reflection of issues on the ground. Rafael Nakachinda says a meeting of stakeholders will enable the UN official to gain a better understanding of the true state of freedom of expression in the Southern African country. Local media report Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Speech, is on a visit to Zambia to assess the country's legal and policy framework for freedom of opinion and expression. Rafael Nakachinda tells me that the international community must be made aware of what he says is the shrinking of democratic space in Zambia.
First of all, we are optimistic that the UN Human Rights Commission Rapporteur has come to Zambia to undertake an independent, objective analysis of what's going on. We hope they will not spend 10 days in Zambia patronizing the government and the institutions of government which have been, you know, polarized to get a narrative advanced by the UPND government. And hence the call that they need to be liberal and engage, first of all, the ordinary citizens of the Republic of Zambia and also critical stakeholders, particularly political players in the opposition, who will be able to give factual and the on-ground experience of the abuses when it comes to issues of human rights abuses and shrinking democratic space. The abuse, if not the stoppage of people's right and freedom of assembly and expression.
The criticism is that some of you are trying so hard to tarnish the hard-earned reputation of Zambia as a peaceful country, with people living side by side in spite of ideological or political differences, and that you are tarnishing the image of the country, including you, by writing to international organizations about what you claim to be poor human rights issues in Zambia, and that is not a true reflection of what is happening on the ground.
Peter, the motivation of writing letters to the international community and so on is motivated by patriotism. Zambia has never known, you know, tribal divisions and consideration for anything in our country from the time we got independence. The only time we had these tribal differences is, just after independence, towards 1970, where Kaunda actually, out of his disgust to tribalism, opted to resign as president. And that is what led to the idea of having a one-party state, which was a wrong move to make altogether. But of course, out of that, there was a mantra established of one Zambia, one nation, and integrating tribes and so on. And therefore, we're saying to partners and colleagues and others who cherish the democratic system of governance, at which Zambia, from the time that we moved to multi-party democracy, we were the pioneers and the torchbearers. And that reputation and legacy is actually fast being destroyed by the UPND. And we are saying all this to say, can we prevent a disaster in Zambia?
What are your expectations of the visiting UN rapporteur in Zambia?
One is that we expect that a clear, factual, objective report will be generated from our visit. We're expecting that the cooperating partners who support Zambia in many ways, including issues of governance, will pay attention. They will be on the ground to see what is going on. When we have by-elections in this country, like we do have two by-elections in one constituency where a member of parliament was abducted and he named the state house staff as those who abducted him, and he has disappeared. We don't know where he is, whether he's alive or dead. We have a by-election in that particular constituency. And we have another by-election in a constituency where a member of parliament, out of fabricated and trumped-up charges, is jailed, and this is all being done with the motivation that they want to increase numbers in parliament so that they can change the constitution to increase, one, the tenure of office of president, and also remove the 50+1 running mate and all those things. And these are agendas that we know the UPND are pushing, but they keep on presenting a picture that what they intend to do is totally different from what we're saying. Until when that is implemented, it will be too late to correct. And therefore, we're saying, may the red or yellow card, before we produce a red card in 2026, draw the attention of the international community to see that there's something wrong happening in Zambia. And I know it's difficult for people to believe, because Zambia has always been a shining light until 2021.
Rafael Nakachinda is the Secretary General of the Zambian opposition coalition called the Tonse Alliance. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, Zambia's Information Minister and Chief Government Spokesperson Cornelius Mwitua denies Nakachinda's allegations. He says the government has uncovered an opposition plot to use fake claims of human rights violations to tarnish the image of the country abroad and to make the government unpopular. Join us on Sunday for my interview with Mwitua. In Tanzania, the main opposition party, Chadema, has elected former presidential candidate Tundu Lissu as its chairman. It defeated incumbent chairman Freeman Mbowe, who had led the party for the past 2 decades. The opposition party's elections were to choose representatives of the group to lead Chadema ahead of the coming general election. Lissu says his main task is to unite and rebuild the main opposition party. It comes after supporters of the party expressed worry that the outcome of the internal elections for the chairmanship of the party could split the group and effectively weaken Chadema in the general election. But Tundu Lissu tells me his election victory is a relief to the supporters of the party. He also says his main task is to fight for institutional, constitutional, and democratic and electoral reforms.
It's a massive, massive accomplishment personally. But I think even more importantly, it is a major relief for the party rank and file and for the country as a whole. This election was followed very closely by millions of Tanzanians at home and abroad. And people were rightly fearful that should it go the other way, the party would possibly have split right down the middle. And therefore, my election has come as a major relief. I think we will emerge from the election, from the experience, not only with euphoria, but with renewed optimism and dedication.
Have you extended an olive branch to your rival, the former chairman, Freeman Mbowe?
Chairman Mbowe was kind enough to concede defeat immediately after it became clear that I was cruising to victory. He generously conceded, and I immediately responded by assuring him in front of the members and on the nation as a whole, that he will remain our party chairman. He served this party with great dedication for 20 years. We will respect him, we'll continue to respect him as an elder statesman of the party now that he's retired. So I extended an olive branch immediately after news trickled in that I had prevailed.
But do you think the party will be united now after your election victory, or do you have plans to unify the party following the election?
The biggest and most urgent task at hand right now is to reunite the party, to heal the wounds that resulted from this bruising campaign. And I think that I come in highly qualified for that purpose. I think, as I said, my victory has been received with massive enthusiasm across the country, and that will help to unify the party.
But you will be wearing a double hat, chairman of the party, representing the party in the presidential contest to challenge incumbent president, this time Sami Asoluu Hassan. How do you plan juggling these two?
You're going up ahead of yourself. I don't have, and the party doesn't have, any presidential candidate at this time. In fact, if I may say so, our position at this time is that if there are no democratic reforms, there will be no election. We do not intend to go back to contesting elections under the conditions which saw us defrauded in only 2 months ago in the local elections and 5 years ago during the general election. We do not intend to go back to contesting elections under the current constitutional and legislative arrangement. Our most urgent task at this time is to fight for democratic reforms, constitutional reforms, institutional reforms, reforms of the electoral system. That is the most important thing at this time. I don't wear that other second hat you're talking about.
So what should the people of Tanzania expect from you moving forward?
I think the people of Tanzania should expect what they have always expected from me, and that is dedicated leadership, fearless, straightforward, determined, kind of politics, honest politics, politics of commitment to ideals and not to petty issues. So the people of Tanzania should expect great things from my leadership in the next few years.
Tundu Lissu is the new chairman of the main Tanzania opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. A member of Sierra Leone's parliament is calling for a transparent and independent investigation into a report of a diplomatic vehicle alleged to be carrying illicit drugs in neighboring Guinea. It comes after authorities in Guinea said they had seized a Sierra Leonean diplomatic vehicle allegedly carrying drugs. The ambassador's driver was at the wheel of the car. The administration in Freetown has since recalled the ambassador over the incident. But parliamentarian Adi Macaulay, a lawyer from the main opposition All People's Congress, expressed concern about the development, saying the legislature needs swift and decisive action over the incident. Adi Macaulay tells me the incident is an embarrassment for the people of Sierra Leone, who he says need answers from the government.
Yes, as you are aware, there are allegations that the Guinean authorities found 7 suitcases of substance suspected to be cocaine in a diplomatic vehicle being driven by the driver of the ambassador crossing from the Sierra Leonean end into the Guinean end. So it is something of a national issue. It is something of also an international concern because it involves our relationship with our Nano River neighbor, the Republic of Guinea. So I am calling for a public inquiry so we should be able to get to the bottom of this.
Talking about public inquiry, what should that entail?
the president under the 1991 constitution has the authority to call for public inquiries into issues of this nature. We cannot bring in the security forces to be part of that public inquiry. Probably they can be witnesses, but we have judges and retired judges that we can safely put that in their hands. But the reality is this. This is not a political issue to start with. It is a national issue because it has national security implications and poses serious societal problems for our youth in this country. So it is just important that we as a country are able to get to the bottom of this and hold responsible those that are found to be culpable.
Talking about politics, some of your critics say that this is an opportunistic call to score cheap political points.
It isn't, because I am a Sierra Leonean. I hold a Sierra Leonean passport. And when the property of Sierra Leone, that is the vehicle which the drug was found in, becomes the issue of an international embarrassment, my passport that I hold gets affected, because when I go to Guinea tomorrow, they will be watching me with suspicious eyes.
Your critics are saying the ambassador has been recalled as part of the investigation to determine what happened. Isn't this a welcoming development?
Well, we've had issues of public concern in the past where government will come out and make a statement that we are going to look into this, we will come out with our report in the shortest possible time, and that is the end of it. And we don't want this to be just one of those issues where people just wait for a few weeks to go by and everyone forgets about it. We are not going to forget about this. We will make sure that we get to the bottom of this. Don't forget, when President Biya took office 6-7 years ago, he promised us that he was going to rebrand Sierra Leone. You know, when you look at the Diplomatic Convention on Diplomatic Relations, the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, the residences, offices, and properties of embassies, including vehicles, are inviolable, meaning that you cannot breach them, you cannot go into them, you cannot search them. And if we start finding drugs in embassy property, then it opens up Sierra Leonean diplomats all over the world to become the subject of suspicion and also the subject of being embarrassed by them losing their inviolability. So this is not a political issue, but an issue of national concern. The National Crimes Agency in the UK just in December last year convicted some British citizens that were found to have loaded cocaine weighing about 1.3 tons from Sierra Leone to Folkestone port in Suffolk in the UK. They were sentenced to about cumulative 75 years cumulatively. And also the Bureau of National Narcotics and Law Enforcement in America, in its country report, says that drug trafficking remains prevalent in Sierra Leone, with it being used as a transshipment point from South America, Asia to Europe, and to a lesser extent to the United States. So we cannot just sit by as citizens and see all these allegations being levied against our country and not doing anything about it. We have to come out, ask the government to make sure that they hold those responsible and bring them to book.
Attorney Adam McCauley is a Sierra Leonean Member of Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Broadcasting in the Luo language, a Kenyan journalist is reaching indigenous women via radio to improve media literacy and combat disinformation. For VOA, Victoria Amunga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The evening show on Dada Radio gets underway in Kenya's Siaya County. The program Minyalo, meaning women can do it, broadcasts in the local Luo language. Dada, which means sister in Swahili, is the only women-oriented station in this community. Its founder, Harriet Etiang, started the station in 2023 to empower women and girls in Siaya, a fishing and farming community.
When you look at the issues like cultural beliefs that women are supposed to be him and not to be her, we realize that again, worsened by the growing technology, the group of women will be left behind with them
But more exposure to the modern world coupled with skills in media literacy make a positive change for listeners like Mary Owadi. She says, I have learned that when it comes to information, I have to verify it first before sharing it with anyone else, because without that, the other person could also just spread lies. So you must verify thoroughly. Atiang uses her platform to inform audiences about issues including gender-based violence and health, and she offers workshops.
For the community, I trained 18 women and 5 men. It was also important because most of the people I trained are members of our internal group. So you're not being in the community. There's something that, the community regards them a bit with a bit of a higher opinion.
Insufficient access to credible information for Kenya's rural areas often makes them vulnerable to disinformation. That makes broadcasting in local languages more important, says Queen Tambori of the Association of Media Women in Kenya.
We are also creating awareness around how they can stay safe. And we are partnering with different organizations now to, respond to the issues that are coming up from misinformation, disinformation. These are issues like, the mental health awareness.
Finding ways to combat disinformation can help break the cycle, says experts. Here is Patrick Butler from the International Center for Journalists.
We have what we call training of trainers. So we want to help this program spread more widely by giving a journalist like Harriet the skills to become trainers themselves. And they are working in communities that may be especially vulnerable to disinformation.
Efforts like Dada Radios, which build on the long history of trust that community stations have with their listeners, are seen by analysts as one way to reach these groups more effectively. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first... Right now it's time for music from our African collection. From the continent, and we hope you enjoy it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mugwill Yabaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, those who beat the drums of shame for you shall dance to it by themselves. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.